We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 18th of May, in the glorious future year of 2024, and I am coming to you by pre-recording, because I have a terrible wry neck. I managed to get an appointment with a massage therapist, but it overlaps this time slot. Well, what are you going to do? That's life sometimes. Anyway, I don't really have time to clean up this recording, as is my usual habit, so it'll be a little rougher than the pre-recorded shows that you may be accustomed to, but hopefully no worse than the usual live show. There's also no particular theme for this week's show. It's mostly a miscellany of things that have come to my attention in the last little while. The number one important thing is undoubtedly that I sat down over the last couple of days and redid the graphs for blast number one, made some new hatching patterns for the bar and pie charts, and rearranged the pie charts to break out things that are grouped. In other words, for example, so that fossil and non-fossil energies, where they're grouped together in the key, are also grouped together in the graph, which should make it a little easier to understand what I'm getting at. And so I feel reasonably confident at this point of putting it to bed, releasing it to the wider audience, which is good considering all the effort that I've put into it. It wouldn't make much sense to keep sitting on it. I've sat on it for about 6 months at this point, considering that the first sample copies were handed out at the end of November last year. And unfortunately, this is typical of the way that I do things. Something that I noticed while traveling in Germany and through Switzerland was the presence, even in small rural towns, of apartment complexes, three-story walk-up blocks of flats. And at first it seems very surprising to see these on the outskirts of little rural villages. Most people would associate apartment blocks with cities. But I asked myself, who do you suppose lives there, and how do they live in the United States? In other words, the analogous people. How do people like that live in the United States? And the answer is, I think, in the U.S. You don't see them as obviously because they live in trailers. In trailer parks, typically, these are clustered around even our fairly large cities in many cases, and a lot of low-income people live there. Some of them own the trailers, but they don't own the land they're on. Some of them rent the trailers as well as the land. And because the land can always be sold out from under them, as the development of the city advances, it's kind of a precarious living situation. I've talked about this before, how I think that one of the priorities of the Department of Housing and Urban Development in the U.S. should be to help the people living in these trailer parks to organize into cooperatives and purchase the trailer parks so that they don't have to worry about being pushed out. In Europe, where land is more expensive, it makes sense to put up apartment blocks for this kind of housing instead. And overall, there seems to be a somewhat different attitude towards housing in general. In the Netherlands, they have just formed a new government, and it's considered quite hard right-wing. It's one of these governments that says, all our problems are caused by immigrants, and we must expel them by force. And yet, part of their policy is more social housing. I have to say that I'm completely baffled by these European right-wingers claiming that all their problems are due to immigrants, because Europe has, to be very blunt, if you don't count immigrants, been losing population for a long time. Of course, during the 19th century, a lot of Europeans emigrated to North America, either because they were poor or couldn't get ahead where they were, for example, because all the land was owned by somebody else. I have a friend who will show you the letter that his grandfather received from his brother, who had migrated to Canada from Scotland, containing what he calls the fatal words, "I've bought a house," which was simply not possible in Scotland because the land tenure essentially excluded most everybody. Well, Europe has been losing population, exclusive of wars, for a long time, and the birth rates have been quite low in the second half of the 20th century. So, bluntly put, they need people coming from somewhere else. They just have no idea how to assimilate them into the culture in many cases. I will say I feel that the French have done better than most. You know, France, of course, had an enormous colonial empire at one time, and if you go to Paris, you encounter a lot of North Africans and Equatorial Africans, you know, people who are obviously, by their style of dress or by their appearance, not originally from France, but it's clear that this is their home now. And France has some difficulty adjusting to that, but I think they're doing a better job of it than most European countries. Now, what really baffles me is, for example, in Hungary, where Viktor Orban's far-right government is constantly blaming the EU for bringing vast numbers of migrants and refugees who are going to destroy their way of life. Well, as you can guess, there have not been great floods of migrants and refugees and asylum seekers into Hungary. People from North Africa, people from the Levant, they want to go to Italy or France or maybe Germany, someplace where they're likely to speak the language, because, of course, Italy and France were major colonial powers, right? They dominated North Africa for, you know, 100 years, beginning 1850, let's say. There's still a lot of people who know how to speak French or Italian, at least well enough that they could get along if they fetched up in France or Italy. And similarly, of course, with the long history, since the beginning of the 20th century at least, of back and forth between Germany and Turkey, there's lots of folks in the Levant, if they're not, say, Syrians or Lebanese who speak French, they have some competency in German. And so, again, if they fetched up in Germany, they could make some kind of life for themselves there. But none of them, absolutely none of them, speaks Magyar. Nobody speaks Magyar, and nobody wants to go to Hungary. My suspicion is, in fact, that the trouble the Hungarians are having is much less immigration than emigration. In other words, that because of the European Union, the scientists and engineers and physicians, people with highly paid skills, find that they can get paid better in other EU countries, in Western EU countries. I mean, the same thing even happened within Germany itself after German reunification. Because there was no investment forthcoming to upgrade the factories and universities and institutes and so on in Eastern Germany to Western standards, they couldn't compete and they closed. And so the ordinary factory operatives and so on were left out of work, leading to a great deal of political unrest there, which continues to this day. Whereas the physicians and the engineers and the scientists, in many cases, migrated into Western Germany, and that is one of the factors which has driven the cost of housing in the Munich area, for example, just to absolutely ludicrous heights. Whereas there's a lot of places in Eastern Germany where there are apartment buildings that they can't give the space away. We shall see, of course, whether this new Dutch government stands by the previous government's policy of building new nuclear power plants there. I think there's a good chance that they will, simply because the new government has a lot of support from the farmers' protest movements which broke out the last year or two. Basically, people saying, yes, we want to address climate change, but we don't think that banning fertilizer, banning tractors, and so on is the way to do it. I suspect strongly that they would be much more open to decarbonizing the electricity supply, perhaps decarbonizing the heat supply in the major cities using nuclear energy. Now, the Generation Atomic Ambassadors teleconference this past week was interesting. Special guest was a gentleman, Mark Haynes, who was vice president of General Atomics for about 15 years, is now retired, and he retired to a place in rural West Virginia, where he actually lives in an off-grid house with a rooftop solar system, because as he says, he's a couple of kilometers away from the nearest power line. And so the $50,000 or so for batteries and panels and all that, which could actually run a reasonable household, was an economically attractive option for him. But he's gotten concerned because he's right over the border between Virginia and West Virginia. So he's basically due east of Washington, D.C., and about halfway between him and Washington, north of Richmond, is an area which is seeing data centers being installed at a ferocious rate. And of course, data centers consume lots of electricity, and they need round-the-clock electricity, right? But all of the companies that are building them, Alphabet, that is Google, and Meta Platforms, that is Facebook, and Amazon, and so on, are very eager to tout how they operate on 100% renewable electricity, which means that they need renewable electricity credits, which is as much as to say that they finance building wind and solar projects, which add a certain number of kilowatt hours every year to the grid. The companies take the same number of kilowatt hours off the grid. Of course, they take it in a very dependable round-the-clock way, which is not the way that those projects deliver the kilowatt hours. But they're then able to say, oh, we're 100% renewable energy powered, and they get big tax breaks for that. Now, as I've said, this is a pretty obvious scam, but it has serious real-world consequences. One of them is that in his area in West Virginia, farmers' fields are being turned into photovoltaic installations. And there are also big projects in the work which would clear areas which are currently under tree cover in order to install more PV panels. And as he says, this isn't exactly good for the environment. Oh, sure, you hear about so-called agrovoltaic projects where the panels are mounted far off the ground so that fodder crops can grow under them and you can graze sheep. And you hear about, oh yes, used wind turbine blades being cut up and chunks of them being used for bus shelters and that kind of thing. But that's not what usually happens, because most of the time, the people in charge of these projects are trying to get the maximum of renewable energy credits, the maximum of tax credits, for the minimum of expenditure, and in a minimum time. And so there's serious environmental damage being done. It's not helping the environment. Utility scale, wind and solar, have a tendency in that direction. And of course, as I often point out, they use far more concrete and steel in things like footings and foundations, all that sort of thing, per megawatt hour of lifetime generation than a nuclear power plant uses. That's one of the things that always gets me, is people say, well, you look at nuclear power plants, they're so large, they use so much steel and concrete, they can't possibly be environmentally friendly. Well, if you total up all the steel and concrete used for wind or solar, you come up with a much larger number. It's just that it's in smaller units spread out across the landscape, so you don't see it all at once. The Wall Street Journal, the other day, as a matter of fact, ran a piece about the skyrocketing demand for electricity in Atlanta and Central Georgia generally, where, again, there's a lot of data centers going in. There are also heavy industries. You know, this is the consequence of what's being referred to as reshoring. In other words, trying to move manufacturing and other industries back to the developed countries from places like China, is that it increases energy demand. And there's not the infrastructure in place to provide that. And Georgia Power, of course, has just brought online Vogtle 3 and 4, the first new nuclear units to be installed in the United States in two generations, essentially. They should be building six more to deal with the demand growth in their service area, but they're not. the delays and the cost overruns and so on involved with Vodal 3 and 4 have been very discouraging, although it's very likely that follow-on plants would benefit by some learning experience. Nevertheless, they don't want to stick their necks out. And so what are they going to do to feed that new round-the-clock power demand? They're going to burn more gas. What else can they do? You know, some people want to promote renewables with storage. They say storage will fix everything. Grid-scale storage, we'll use batteries or whatever. That'll fix everything. Well, of course, batteries are very expensive. I shouldn't have to tell anyone that. And along that line, there was a very interesting study out of the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule. That's the Swiss Federal Technical University. Now, it's a very timely study because back on April 22nd, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a fascinating event in Switzerland. You see, Switzerland has built a lot of solar generation in the past few years, and there's two kinds. There's solar, which is located high up on the slopes of mountains in areas where it gets more sunlight, and there's solar, which is located down in the valleys. Now, on the 20th and 21st of April, after several weeks of fair weather, there was snowfall, and the result was that rooftop solar in the valleys was basically out of the picture. There was a shortfall of about a gigawatt in generation compared to Friday, which lasted for some hours. And the Swiss Federal Network operator managed to obtain replacement power, so the grid didn't crash, but they were paying at one point 12,000 francs a megawatt hour for it. The whole operation cost them in the vicinity of 30 million francs. Now, a few days like that, and you begin to think that Hinkley Point C in Britain, which has been derided for its ludicrously high guaranteed price for the power of 89.5 pounds sterling or 102 Swiss francs per megawatt hour, that begins to look really attractive. And so this study from the ETH, from the ETH branch at Lausanne, came to a fascinating conclusion. They looked at Switzerland and said, all right, how do we satisfy the electricity needs of Switzerland, assuming we need 113 terawatt hours a year, as opposed to about 66 terawatt hours last year, when you electrify transportation, when you electrify heating of buildings and all that kind of thing? How do we provide it? And they looked at two options, basically. Option A is renewables plus storage. Lots of solar, expand to a great extent the hydroelectric capacity, because, of course, Switzerland, with its alpine topography, is an ideal place for pumped storage. So expand those pumped storage reservoirs greatly, and then use additional summertime electricity to produce hydrogen, and then store that hydrogen and burn it in gas turbines during the winter for combined heat and power schemes. Remembering, of course, that, again, in Switzerland, solar doesn't produce anything during the winter because solar panels do nothing when they're covered with snow. I don't really know if the solar panels up on the mountain slopes interact in any way with avalanche hazards, if they make avalanches more likely, or if they're more likely to be carried away and destroyed in avalanches, etc. But that's a secondary question. And the conclusion they came to is that would cost 563 billion francs, which is about 70% of Switzerland's current annual GDP. So even stretched out over like a 20-year investment period, that's quite a lot. And it doesn't even account for how long some of these investments last before they have to be replaced. But suffice to say, it was expensive. Then they looked at a second option, which was to build 6 to 8 gigawatts of new nuclear power plants. And they came to the conclusion that would cost about 48 billion francs. Now that's more than a 10-to-1 advantage, even though they already reduced significantly from the present values the price of the electrolyzers and the hydrogen storage. And so even if the critics who immediately came out of the woodwork are correct, and nuclear is likely to be twice or even three times as expensive as they estimated, nevertheless, it's still a threefold price advantage at worst. I think this needs to be talked about more. What realistic solar plus storage systems look like compared to realistic systems with nuclear generation. And of course you had the people from the Greens saying, you can't simply extrapolate the past to tell you what the future is going to be, but if you are putting decarbonization on a short time scale, what you're really saying is that next year has to be radically different from this year, which is pretty unlikely. Whereas if we assume that next year is liable to be very similar to this year, which is a much safer assumption, we get these kinds of figures, that the nuclear option is far and away, not just a little, but far and away economically superior. And it's economically superior because it's superior in practice, too. And this, to me, is kind of the key observation. Nuclear is a very practical energy supply technology. It was created specifically to interface well with the needs of an industrial society, and it does that admirably. There have been a lot of articles in the Wall Street Journal recently that I've noticed. An article about a proposed merger between giant mining companies BHP and Anglo American. An article about attempts by the U.S. to obtain a buyout of an Israeli businessman with interests in the Congo who's under sanctions. An article about the run-up in the silver market due to the demand for silver in manufacturing photovoltaic panels. You know, we keep hearing about fascinating new approaches to photovoltaics, and they never get delivered. Instead, we get more of the silicon photovoltaics. And what all these articles have in common is that they're about the enormous demand for rare metals inherent in most projections of a, quote, transition to a clean energy future. It's the sort of thing that makes you dubious about that clean bit. Nuclear, obviously, has its requirements for zirconium as well as for uranium and that sort of thing. But again, they're on a much more modest scale because they're used much more efficiently. And because it doesn't require the same level of sophisticated smart grid technologies and batteries this and storage that and everything of that nature, nuclear allows you to do more with the cheaper engineering materials, steel and concrete and aluminum. I keep coming back to district heating and cooling schemes, again, using ordinary water as the heat transfer medium. In fact, as I may have mentioned before, water is also used as the refrigerant in low-temperature absorption chillers of the kind that would work off of low-grade heat from the bottom end of the thermodynamic cycle of a steam power plant. This is a safety advantage, of course. You know, early refrigeration systems frequently used ether or ammonia, which are poisonous and explosive. Then we invented the chlorofluorocarbons, which have been banned because of their effect on the ozone layer. Then we brought in hydrofluorocarbons to replace the CFCs, but those are now being banned because of their extreme global warming effect. So what are the new refrigerants being used in vapor compression mechanical refrigeration systems, which of course have seals that can leak? Propane, butane, hexane, pentane. In other words, highly flammable hydrocarbons. Now, the quantities in any one refrigeration system are fairly small, but still, the fact that the refrigerant in low-temperature absorption chiller systems is just plain water has to be counted as a point in its favor simply from the fire insurance perspective. Of course, another aspect of the wind and solar heavy energy strategies is their outsized requirement for transmission lines to move power from where the sun is currently shining, where the wind is currently blowing, to where there's currently load. And there's an extent to which that's just not going to help. For example, much of Europe frequently experiences the same weather pattern all over the continent. If you were to pave the United States with solar cells, you still would get zero output for at least 10 hours out of the average day, and so on. The Federal Electric Regulatory Commission has just issued new rules to try and make it easier and faster and cheaper to build these big transmission lines, but most of all to guarantee that they'll be there when they're required. And there's a lot of controversy about this because there are some people who say, well, I don't want any of this renewable energy anyway. I'm happy to keep burning coal, so why do I have to pay for it? And again, I have to come back to the basic fact that nuclear power plants can be built close to the load because they don't require geographical features the way that hydro plants do. They don't require the transportation of enormous quantities of fuel the way that coal plants do. Nuclear fuel can literally be transported by air because the fuel value per kilogram or per cubic meter is so large that even transporting it by air doesn't add meaningfully to the cost of the fuel. The result is that a nuclear-powered country or continent requires far less in the way of transmission lines. Sure, you still want to link the various areas so that if generation goes down in one place, you can transfer emergency power so that also you can serve a certain amount of the peak load without building new power plants. It comes down, in that case, to a balance between the cost of the transmission lines and the cost of additional power plant capacity. But you don't have a requirement to move tens of gigawatts across the continent constantly, which is what any renewable energy scenario for North America or Europe demands. So yeah, I think about that kind of thing a lot. It basically boils down to the question, is the tool you are trying to apply appropriate for the task at hand? And nuclear energy is really good for the task of powering a modern industrial society. Wind and solar just aren't, and we have to face that reality in order to make sensible policy choices for the years ahead. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101. I'll probably read them out on the air. I'll probably send you something in return. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam. And coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
So this is our first show for the year 2022. Imagine that. And in fact, today is, of course, the first day of 2022, so this is the first day in 2022 when we could be having a show. So that's kind of nifty. Yeah. What else is there to be said about that? Well, not a lot. Of course, on the 25th, which was Christmas Day, which is when we had our last show, there was the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, which, of course, is much anticipated. Been a long time coming. part of the reason why it's been a long time coming is that it was initially supposed to have been launched on the what they call the Ares 5 launch vehicle, which has now essentially been rebranded as the Space Launch System, but for a while there it was canceled.
7.